Welcome to Ask a Doctor, what your doctor wants you to know with Dr. Virgie. Over the next hour, you'll learn valuable medical tips from health policy to personal finance and medical debt management. Now listen close and welcome your host, Dr. Virgie Bright Ellington.
To find out what your patient activist doctor wants you to know, I reached out to Dr. Mitchell Lee. Dr. Lee is a North Carolina-based board-certified emergency medicine physician, founder of Thrive Direct Care, which is a subscription-based direct primary care service that provides direct access to a primary care physician for an affordable monthly fee with no co-pays, and the founder of Take Medicine Back, an advocacy organization which educates the public regarding the corporate takeover of American medicine, which has led to the financial exploitation of patients and the erosion of trust between healthcare providers and patients. Dr. Mitchell Lee's official professional motto is hashtag do no financial harm, a really important twist on the Hippocratic oath of do no harm. Dr. Lee, thank you so much for joining us today. I am so excited to talk to you. You know, I'm a huge, huge fan of your work. I think the work you're doing is paradigm changing, but you know, I got to ask you, when do you sleep? How do you juggle all of this?
Thank you so much for having me. I guess I do make a lot of use of stubbornness and caffeine. And then as most emergency physicians can tell you, we're pretty good at rapid task switching or multitasking. And I have a little overhead in my life, so I try not to overwork myself so I can pursue some passions.
Very smart. You know, I'm curious, emergency room docs, emergency medicine physicians, who, because of the way the American healthcare system is structured, normally aren't aware of the financial problems that many folks get into because of the care that has been provided to them. Can you tell us how you became a patient activist educating the public about the American corporate takeover of medicine, which has led to this huge, devastating financial exploitation of patients? And the story about how you come to do this work has to be a really interesting one.
I'd be happy to, and I would start with probably the idea that I think you probably know as a physician, that very few physicians are literate in the business of medicine or any of the obscure financial workings of insurance companies, pharmacy benefit management companies, consolidation of those payers, consolidation of the quote-unquote providers or hospital systems. It's so much to unravel that it's very difficult to understand for most people. And honestly, a lot of these inequities, financial inequities, are leading and fueling, I think, conspiracy theories and things that led to the January 6th attack. We got pretty ugly. And the truth is that we have a lot of corruption, but it's so complex that most people don't understand exactly where it's from. So some of that anger gets misdirected at your local physician or, a lot of our profession, and we end up experiencing some moral injury.
We are not taught any of this in med school, definitely not med school. And we're not taught any of it in any residency program, primary care, subspecialty, surgical, emergency medicine, none of it. We're not taught any of it. And it's interesting because, to your point, the American patient, think that physicians are the ones that are behind the the problem, and we're not. We still lost the control. That the American physician has lost control over the healthcare system decades and decades ago. We're just pawns and employees like everyone else. And I know you can take us through the story and explain that, how this happened and how we all got here.
We are kind of an easy scapegoat. And to be fair, there, of course, are some physicians now and in the past that have helped literally aid and abet the corporate practice of medicine or have sort of just sold out. And so, unfortunately, our names as like regular physicians and in the ER or working in the community end up being sort of conflated with the physicians who maybe have brought us here in collaboration with a lot of big financial interests. And then when the patients see a bill from me as an emergency physician, even if I don't have no control at all of what that bill is, I'm not even told what is billed or collected in my name by the system that I work for. I'm talking in generalities. I don't work for one of those systems now. It looks like the physician is the one sending a very exploitative bill. Mm-hmm. The name of the private equity company, the CEO of the company, their name's not on the bill, but they're the ones designing this system. But the patient saw me, or maybe they didn't even see me. Maybe they saw a nurse practitioner and my name's still on that bill because my license is being used to exploit physicians and patients. So it's a really difficult situation that we're in. And I think a lot of physicians have kind of hid from the limelight because, you know, we might get torn apart in society. So that's a bit of what drives me. I'm certainly happy to go back and discuss how I did get here.
Yeah. You know, that's a great intro, Dr. Lee, because I'd like to hear your story about how you got here. You know, my story is, you know, I told the story that, you know, I was a primary care physician for many years and a private healthcare insurance executive for many years, and, you know, got a 360 view of the American healthcare system, or so I thought, until I became a patient and saw what was going on and what was being done to patients. And I thought, holy crap, I had no idea. So I'd love to hear your story about how you came to, you know, your journey and, you know, being made aware of what's happening to the American patient, or really how the American patient is just basically a cost victim of the U.S. healthcare system.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, your story of once you became a patient, saw a different angle of it. I mean, I had one of those experiences that certainly was eye-opening. And I think we start to realize how much we're maybe actually intentionally kept in the dark about this business so that those in control can, you know, exploit the situation as much as possible. So my journey started back in, you know, when I was a Boy Scout, I got the first aid merit badge and I really liked that, and just knowing how to like take care of bleeding. And that was just something that interested me in medicine. And that was probably the way it kind of started that I got interested. And my mom worked in a lab at while I was in high school. And so I got some experience, just exposure to science. And I said, okay, maybe we can combine these things. Maybe I could become a physician, maybe not. It wasn't a definite career goal for me. In undergrad, I studied initially medical laboratory science. I was more going down that sort of science route. And then I took a public health elective and realized that that was really, really what was interesting to me. So I switched my major to health science, which was really health science, public health, health policy. And that gave me a bit of a flavor early on for this. I did get into medical school. I went to UMass Medical School in Massachusetts. And I had considered continuing on as a paramedic because I worked as an EMT at the time, and then getting a degree in public health and making that sort of my academic life. But of course, I went down that route of becoming a physician. And I was very much between becoming a primary care family physician, having realized the importance of primary care, you know, from a health policy standpoint as well. And in between becoming an emergency physician, because I loved a little bit of adrenaline and the ability to resuscitate a patient when things are true emergencies. That's just something that I'm drawn to and still am. So during medical school, I was at University of Massachusetts, which is a public school and a little bit more affordable than the average school. But I went to a private undergrad and tuition and fees were still rising when I was in medical school. And this plays into a lot of colors my world. I did get involved in the American Medical Association and locally speaking, the Massachusetts Medical Society and the Worcester District Medical Society. And I still stayed involved in health policy throughout medical school. After I graduated, I did a residency at St. John Hospital in Detroit as an emergency and for my emergency medicine residency. And, you know, that's fairly all encompassing. So I didn't have a lot of extra time or bandwidth to get involved in the politics at that point. So I was a bit tunnel visioned into just getting experience. By the time that was nearly over, and there's a bit of story here. Of course, I had racked up a bunch of debt somewhere in the range of $330,000 of educational debt. And I was probably one of the more lucky ones. We talk about averages. We don't talk about mean, median, and mode. There are outliers that pull this very high. There are some people who have zero debt and some people who have $700,000 of educational debt. And that is crippling for many folks. I know of a young woman, single mother, who came out with $700,000 in educational debt from residency. So this was going in the back of my mind because I was considering pursuing a fellowship either in EMS or critical care medicine, but there was no way I was going to pay off debt. You know, it was time to start paying that off. And it was during that time period, during my first job, I met a good friend of mine in a similar situation. We did what we would call personal finance journal club together, where we basically discussed how we weren't going to fall into the typical trappings of a physician who doesn't know anything about finance and, you know, buy a big house and a Porsche and put all of your kids into private school and then you live paycheck to paycheck in the McMansion. And that was super helpful. Meanwhile, I had just graduated from my program, and that program had the physician group there had sold to a group called Team Health. Team Health, this will come into play a little bit later. It is owned by Blackstone Corporation, which is a massive, I think it's the world's largest private equity firm. And many people don't know the name of that. And certainly when you come to the hospital, you don't realize that it's really a big private equity corporation that's treating you and barely the physician anymore. So that occurred during my residency. But again, I was still kind of head in the sand, or at least trying to learn all the clinical aspects. And it was during that financial self-education. And, you know, I can certainly credit initially reading about things from White Coat Investor and Physician on Fire and introducing the concepts here. Those were extremely helpful. I actually heard a podcast on Dr. Money Matters, two podcasts that were very influential to me. One was about direct primary care, and one was about private equity in medicine. And so neither of those things was directly related to me figuring out how to pay off my loans. So at first I kind of skipped over them. And my good friend, Dr. Tanner, had said, you know, why don't you listen to those podcasts again? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I just want to pay off my $330,000 in loans, but I'll take a listen. And it took a couple of listens, but I realized, oh my goodness, some paradigm changing things. One was, how much do labs cost? And this is about direct primary care. Josh Umber is quite well known in the community of direct primary care. And he started discussing wholesale lab costs and transparent lab. And if you think of CBC, CMP, TSH, A1C, lipid panel, and you know, to the lay audience, basically your annual labs that you get at your doctor, how much do those cost? And I've asked a physician audience as well. And I get every answers from $50 to $150 to $3,000. Nobody knows, right? These are physicians and we have no clue. Mm-hmm. And part of that's because we get a bill and those bills are all over the place ourselves. And we think that, okay, it's a made up number, but the insurance, you know, negotiates and it's all behind smoke and mirrors. Well, when I learned that a CBC costs about, a complete blood count costs about $3.50, that we can actually get that and pass that on to our patients. And maybe we mark it up by 15% so that maybe it's like $3.83, that this can be completely affordable without insurance, and that insurance perhaps actually serves a role of marking up the prices and inflating them in a really massive way in most circumstances. We know that insurance as a concept has a role, but maybe paying for routine medical care is just raising the cost of healthcare and allowing a sort of corrupt, obscure industry to profit. So that was about the same time that I learned about private equity from Kurt Schoep. I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly, who discussed private equity buying up medical practices. And I realized this is what happened to the residency that I was at. So I started putting all these little dots together and learned enough about personal finance at that point. I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole. I spent countless hours just studying how to open up a direct primary care practice. There's a bit of like learned helplessness and some philosophy or feeling from physicians that, you know, we don't own our practice. I mean, we literally don't in most circumstances. And we seem to need to get permission from a hospital to do things. When we realized that actually buying all those supplies, medications, it's all our license that is there. So we can actually start our own you know, direct care practices and hang out a shingle, like, you know, old school medicine. So that was really appealing to me. And I do continue that through my practice, Thrive Direct Care. I had been really inspired by that direct primary care community. So, and I continue to be, because I think they bring an extremely important conversation to the table about being able to practice with autonomy, doing the best for your patient without insurance or private employer like a hospital or private equity group practicing medicine and constraining how you practice. It becomes much more pure, and I really love that. At the same time, I'm a board certified emergency physician and got involved in some advocacy within my specialty. I heard I connected with Dr. Robert McNamara, who is the second president of the American Academy of Emergency Medicine, and realized that there is a whole history of corporate corruption in emergency medicine that has snowballed. Dr. James Keeney, who was known as the Phoenix because he feared retaliation at the time that he wrote the book, wrote a book called The Rape of Emergency Medicine in 1992. That book is a quasi-fictional account of how corporate ills were sort of taking hold in emergency medicine. Contract management groups were popping up, and there were a few physicians who realized that they could make more money with less liability and less work simply by scheduling their other physicians to work and commoditizing them. At that point, we started to have this circumstance where physicians weren't really hired for their quality and dedication to patients, but rather it became profits over patients. And that started in my specialty to a large degree. So there was a concern that the American College of Emergency Physicians was partially responsible, that some of their leaders were the ones pioneering this model. And that led to the formation of the American Academy of Emergency Medicine, which is, I guess you could say, an alternative, sometimes referred to as the conscience of emergency medicine, which is unfortunate because the whole thing should have a conscience and we shouldn't have to have that. They've made a lot of changes and there's been a lot of advocacy over the years. We felt like we needed more of that, and not just to have a specialty society that hosts a scientific assembly, but also to have one that is pure advocacy and starts to have conversations with specialties outside of emergency medicine and also transdisciplinary outside of medicine altogether, because we're going to lose this battle to corruption if we stay siloed. So that's a bit of where we come now. But while I've been working in my direct care practice, I've had the incentive to really dive down, deconstruct the corruption and find ways to bypass that. And for example, create or learn all of the tricks and hacks, and hence the book that we're working on, How to Hack Your Healthcare. How can I advocate for patients who are uninsured or underinsured, and what alternatives exist? So that's a bit of what brought me to this point now.
You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie on the Voice America Health and Wellness channel. We'll be back after this short break.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Are you one of the millions of Americans struggling with their medical bills? Now there is a way to get the health care you need and take care of your financial life. Dr. Virgie Bright Ellington is an internal medicine physician, and she's a determined patient advocate, helping people reduce and even eliminate their medical debt. Become a member today and discover how to free yourself from a lifetime of bills at crushmedicaldebt.com. Join the Crush Medical Debt community today. Sign up at crushmedicaldebt.com.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie. If you have a question for Dr. Virgie or her guests, you can email Dr. Virgie at dr.virgie@crushmedicaldebt.com. Now back to the show. Here again is Dr. Virgie.
Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
You talked a little bit about Blackstone, the private equity group that the average American has never heard of. That's the the actual ownership of much of emergency medicine, because a lot of physicians who practice or specialize in emergency medicine are hired in employment groups. They're hired by employers, right? And until this year's No Surprise Billing Act was put into place, was signed into law, and it went into effect this year, January 1st, to address this issue, the business model of these private equity corporations, Blackstone, KKR, was to take advantage of the fact that they could say, okay, we don't take any insurance. So it doesn't matter what insurance you have, we don't take it, so we can charge whatever we want. There is an article that came out, I think you mentioned it, in Fortune magazine recently, that gets into a little bit of that. Can you talk a little bit about that also?
Yeah, and those are probably two thoughts. So the article you just referred to in Fortune magazine, I think you're referring to the one that points out that a large hospital corporation is super successful, it's profiting, it's doing well. Why is one community trying to run it out of town? Probably paraphrasing the title, but that refers to Asheville, North Carolina, where the Hospital Corporation of America, which is a publicly traded company founded by, Thomas Frist Jr., who, if you were to Google him, topped the list of international healthcare billionaires. It's a very successful company if you're talking to an investor. It's also destroying medicine if you're talking to a lot of nurses and physicians. And Hospital Corporation America is similar to many other large consolidated hospital systems in that they also contract out with physician groups, or like we can't even call them physician groups anymore because they don't all staff physicians, but with staffing groups, provider staffing groups that tend to be very consolidated themselves. For example, Team Health, and Team Health is the group that bought out the residency program where I was training. So it all kind of comes full circle there. They're contracted out with Team Health in this region of North Carolina, as is LifePoint, which is a private equity owned hospital system. So it's one thing, there's many state laws, corporate practice of medicine laws. Most states have something on the book that prohibits a corporation from employing a physician or practicing medicine. However, there are a lot of lawyers that they hire, and they find ways to bypass these. The main way is to take a physician who's willing to sign away their license and serve as a paper owner. A paper owner is just somebody who on paper, it looks like they own the hospital or they own the physician group, but in reality, they've been stripped of shareholder rights, which means they don't really have any control. So they're kind of on corporate welfare, just basically you're using their name to aid and abet the corporate practice of medicine by these big companies. Now, Blackstone was in, you can find it in the news, but you could also read about it in Peter Goodman, in the New York Times, global economic correspondent, wrote the book Davos Man, How Billionaires Devoured the World. And Stephen Schwartzman and Blackstone are a feature in that as to how this sort of happened. There's kind of the ultimate version of, I'll call it cronyism and crony capitalism, is probably in private equity. So these groups load companies up with debt. They buy them, but they mostly buy them with debt. And the private equity firms themselves don't actually take on the risk. If the company goes bankrupt, or if they default on the loan, it's actually the company that they purchased that is liable. So these private equity firms work in such a way that they take no risks, but they place the rest of the risks on society. Outside of emergency medicine, we're talking about like Toys R Us and JCPenney. Lots of retail. And in many cases, like Toys R Us went bankrupt, and a lot of that was because they couldn't pay off their extreme debt. It results in labor exploitation and, you know, cutting. You need to squeeze basically in order to pay off this debt. So one end of the equation is to generate more revenue in emergency medicine. That's surprise billing. And it's also just taking over as many hospitals as possible. And the other half of the equation is the expense portion. And of course, if you're a staffing company that staffs doctors, then your expense is going to be doctors. So what's the way that you approach that? Well, you decrease the number of doctors in total. You maybe replace them with lower cost non-physician practitioners. And at the same time, patients end up paying more. So the out-of-network surprise billing fiasco, I guess you could say, was largely driven by Team Health and Envision, which are both respectively owned by Blackstone and KKR, another big private equity firm. They actually funded a grassroots, or I guess we could call them an astroturfing campaign, where they pretended to look like patients and physicians, and they had a pack called Doctor-Patient Unity, which made it seem like it was doctors and patients together opposing implementation of the No Surprises Act. It was at least a $28 million campaign that was uncovered by the New York Times. And in this, what really bugs me a lot is that my profession's name is being dragged through the mud during this. If you look at the HHS right now, Javier Becerra had instructed the HHS to identify or study the billing practices of 2,000 or so providers. Now, what is a provider? That doesn't tell me anything. They're actually conflating physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and big hospital systems and corporations with doctors. And I'm not a corporation. I'm not a PA. I'm not an NP. And I'm not a private equity firm. But we're all lumped into the same boat. And that also makes us look pretty bad in society. Meanwhile, physicians, if they bring any of this up, are likely to get fired because these companies go out of their way to make sure that we don't have any worker protection. So we're really no different than any sort of retail blue-collar worker that has no protections, anti-competes or non-competes with anti-competitive restrictive covenants that would keep physicians from working in their own community if they're fired or if they quit an abusive work situation. And it's pretty horrible, and that's something that really drives me there. The out-of-network billing issue, it also hurts small physician groups, because we can argue that one rationale for working with private equity or making bigger physician groups is because the payers are also very consolidated. United Health, Blue Cross Blue Shield, a lot of people would refer to these as the BUCAs, Blue Cross, United, Cigna, Aetna, Humana. I think a merger was actually blocked between Aetna, maybe, and Humana. I won't quote that one, but these health payers are consolidating and have so much market power that maybe the doctors also need to consolidate and fight them. That was a bit of a Faustian bargain, because now many of us are employed by abusive companies, or exploitive companies, I should say. And at this point, I like to just kind of refer to the whole situation as when elephants fight, the grass suffers. And we as physicians and patients and nurses are really the grass, while a bunch of large financial titans battle it out. And we as physicians, I think, need to start taking some leadership back in that. It was a mouthful.
That is a lot. And, you know, a lot to unpack, as they say. And So where do we go from here? Where are you going from here, Dr. Lee? What made you decide, you know what, take medicine back is what I have to do and what we have to do? How did you get from there once you had this epiphany of what was going on in American healthcare? How did you decide, okay, I'm going to take medicine back?
You know, it sounds like a lofty pipe dream kind of a thing, but I also during my time when I was just clinically working and kind of didn't have any control of my life, I feel like I got pretty depressed, and I probably would stay depressed if I weren't fighting for something like this. So, you know, that on a personal level, that's why I have to do it, and it certainly drives me, and it could be against all odds. But I think there's a lot of learned helplessness in medicine.
Can you talk a little bit more about that, about the learned helplessness among physicians?
Yeah, it's weird. It's very demoralizing, I think. And Wendy Dean, the founder of the Moral Injury and Healthcare Foundation, I think speaks very well to this, that maybe we shouldn't be framing things as burnout, but rather moral injury, because we are sort of in a vulnerable position where we're forced to transgress our deeply held moral beliefs. It's a term borrowed from the military. And we have a lot of physicians, particularly now, starting out with enormous debt to the point where you're pretty much feeling like an indentured servant, first in residency, and then afterwards, if you enter a market that's completely consolidated and you're $300,000-$500,000 in debt, add to that with, you know, a significant other and maybe children, and you feel like you have no leverage, no latitude, and you're forced to work in these environments where you're set up to fail. I saw a recent post by a physician in a primary care setting. It was an anonymous post. And it was describing working with Medicare Advantage plans and patients in that, which is a whole nother subject, but similarly, not really a good thing. I refer to them as Medicare disadvantage plans. Mm. It's a sort of a privatization of Medicare with traditional like private health insurance networks. Well, this physician described a case where they have, you know, 10 minutes with a visit with a patient. They somehow discovered that they had a complete carotid occlusion on one artery. I think did a CT angiogram and found a 80% stenosis on the other. So just for the lay audience, that means that like they have a very tiny trickle of blood going to their head, and they could have a large stroke and die or be completely disabled very easily. Well, the United Health, I think it was United, I won't name that, but it very well could be, right, is, you know, declined these or and said wouldn't pay for them, right? So it was
wouldn't
a lot
pay
of
for what?
Denials of the like CT scans. So of the
they
things
would that not. So the doctor during their examination, somehow during the 10 minutes they had with this patient, who sounds like older, clearly a lot of chronic medical problems, happens to find that there's a complete blockage of the artery in one side of, you know, feeding one side of their brain, and on the other side of the brain, just a tiny trickle of blood, that's all. And the physician is asking the insurance company to approve a CT scan, a CT angiogram, which looks at the brain and most importantly, the blood flow to the brain in this case. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's my understanding. And ultimately, this is a doctor who's really advocating for their patient.
Exactly.
But when the patient ends up getting a big bill because of a denial, that
and
patient.
And so the insurance company denied the physician's request, but the patient needed it, so it was done anyway.
That's my understanding.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Circumstance.
I just want to make sure that I'm getting it right, that these are the facts. Yes.
Well, and this is an anonymous post, so mm-hmm. I can't even verify it. But why
but
is this
anonymous?
We know
these things happen. As clinicians, we've seen these things happen. So this is an example. And so what happens after that?
Illustrative, I would say, yes. Mm-hmm. And this was an anonymous post. And why is it an anonymous post? Because the person is afraid that they could possibly lose their job because their clinic manager reprimanded them. This is a non-physician reprimanding a physician that said, don't look as hard. Don't look for problems. So, and so we're in this completely demoralized state where, it, for the most part, we're controlled by non-physicians that are controlled by large, you know, for-profit or tax exempt, but profiteering insurance companies. And then the patient comes and takes it out on us, and we don't have time to talk with the patient. And it looks like it's the physician that is doing things wrong. And so that's just so utterly demoralizing that I think so many physicians feel like they're in that position and maybe can't escape the system. Now, it's a passion of mine, of course, with direct care, direct primary care, direct specialty care. I think we need to bypass that system, and we need to have some degree of financial literacy to do so and some resolve to get out of it.
Yeah, I talk about the fact that without medical financial literacy, the average American has no financial stability. You know, it's because of this that 80 to 90% of Americans are just one injury, one accident, one serious illness away from a lifetime of debt or bankruptcy. It's a reason why, you know, medical bills are the number one cause of debt and bankruptcy in this country. Yeah.
Yeah, financial literacy, we do a poor job of that in the country overall. And I think we had talked about this before, that your book, Crush Medical Debt, is necessary here, but really almost no other country in the world do we need this additional financial literacy.
It's a very uniquely American problem. This is not a problem that exists in any other industrialized countries.
You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. We'll be back after this short break.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Are you one of the millions of Americans struggling with their medical bills? Now there is a way to get the health care you need and take care of your financial life. Dr. Virgie Bright Ellington is an internal medicine physician, and she's a determined patient advocate, helping people reduce and even eliminate their medical debt. Become a member today and discover how to free yourself from a lifetime of bills at crushmedicaldebt.com. Join the Crush Medical Debt community today. Sign up at crushmedicaldebt.com.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie. If you have a question for Dr. Virgie or her guests, you can email Dr. Virgie at dr.virgie@crushmedicaldebt.com. Now back to the show. Here again is Dr. Virgie.
Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
So where do we go next with Take Medicine Back? What's next?
So I like to think of Take Medicine Back as kind of a grassroots think tank and advocacy group. So we stay pretty nimble and are open to additional ideas and broadening, right? So we started as Take EM Back, although officially we incorporated as Take Medicine Back. We're looking to build coalitions and increase discussions with people who believe in the same principles, because those discussions have not really happened. Anesthesia Society has problems with corporate medicine and corporate engagement or infiltration of their specialty society. State medical boards do. Dermatology does. So we haven't had the advocates within each of those specialties be empowered before. So we're starting to really encourage and foster conversations with those other specialties, perhaps influence those specialty groups, and then speak with patient advocates who may have half the story. They're angry, but they think the doctors are in on it. So let's have real conversations with patient advocates. Let's have discussions with, the nurses that are getting poorly staffed at the bedside, and they're a huge component of this exploitation by hospital systems. So we're doing that, and that's part of what our summit in 2022, our Take Medicine Back summit in the fall, is going to focus on, as well as advocacy and a specific strategy to say, let's get our state attorney generals involved in enforcing corporate practice of medicine laws. I have to give credit to the American Academy of Emergency Medicine and Robert McNamara, a CMO of the American Academy Emergency Medicine Physician Group, which is actually suing Envision Health in California, alleging the illegal corporate practice of medicine. And they're not seeking any monetary damages, which is key. They're looking for a judgment. We want to make a change and enforce corporate practice of medicine laws overall. What we're looking at is sort of the mechanisms of corporate abuse. So on the one hand, the Federal Trade Commission is giving me a little bit of hope right now. That would be a focus on consolidation and antitrust law. That's going to take a long time if they're successful. And in the meantime, we need to focus on what are the mechanisms that these groups use aside from monopolies to exploit physicians or patients. And some of those things relate to certificate of need laws. Mm-hmm. You can't open up another competing practice in the same town, so it maintains a monopoly. Imaging centers for where I am now, I can get an MRI for like $1,200 when I could get an MRI for like $300 where I was previously in Chicago when there was some competition. And these are cash prices, no insurance required. So certificate need laws are one component of that. Not enforcing corporate practice of medicine laws are another component. Anti-competitive restrictive language that prevents physicians from practicing in their communities. For example, we talked a little bit about Atrium Advocate Aurora just merged. So a physician who is in North Carolina, who maybe got fired or quit from a job there, couldn't work within a certain distance of Advocate Aurora because in the Midwest. So these non-competes aren't even that local. We're talking about physicians can't work in like almost any community when there's these large labor monopsonies. So we're exploring these mechanisms and seeing what can be done from a legislative, regulatory, and awareness and voter standpoint to address these mechanisms of corporate greed and exploitation. I do want to get back to the Federal Trade Commission at some point, because I think that's going to be a broader conversation in American society over the next couple of decades too, but I'll stop there.
Well, let's talk about that. Tell us about the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and the impact in this issue.
Sure. So I started diving into it, Take Medicine Back and I where it was invited to speak in front of the Federal Trade Commission April 14th on merger guidelines and consolidation in healthcare. I spoke alongside a number of nurses, physicians, lay advocates, and pharmacists, speaking about, pharmacy benefit management companies and some corruption in that world, the cost of insulin that we're all very acutely aware of. And what I realized over the past year is that the new chair, Lena Khan, is an attorney who actually was a Biden appointee, but passed Senate confirmation 69-28. And that's quite remarkable in today's polarized politics, because if you look at the Supreme Court nominee, nothing passes without, it's like 50-50 and then a tiebreaker from the vice president. And so it seemed to me that Lena Khan was striking a really weird chord, because there's almost nothing bipartisan that we talk about nowadays, except maybe the war in Ukraine. It seems to be something bringing people together. Traditionally, Republicans might have been looked at as being pro big business and pro business, and anti big government. And Democrats are the opposite, right? That's just a caricature. But what I think we're finding right now is that a lot of the Republican side of the Congress and Senate are realizing that maybe big tech isn't really their favorite thing. And that consolidation, whether it's big tech or big hospitals or big insurance companies or big government, maybe consolidation in any one of those groups is actually not a good thing. And I think we're finally starting to see eye to eye in a productive manner. Some people might love that Amazon pulled the plug on Parler after, January 6th. But a lot of people don't. And realizing that they had all of that power from a private standpoint to silence conversation bothered a lot of people. And Lena Khan wrote her thesis, I believe it was called The Amazon Antitrust Paradox. And that was a harken back to, I believe it was Bork in the 1980s, who wrote The Antitrust Paradox, which essentially, in a nutshell, eviscerated what the Federal Trade Commission did. That's a longer discussion, but back in the 80s, sort of Reaganomics was the time when the Federal Trade Commission really stopped doing the job of the Federal Trade Commission, in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of Lena Khan. So Lena Khan comes along, gets a lot of bipartisan support, and has a much more aggressive, and it's been labeled progressive, agenda for the Federal Trade Commission. I've started Amy Klobuchar's book, Antitrust. And if you look back to the days of Teddy Roosevelt, politicians ran on platforms of bust the trusts or, anti-monopoly. And so this conversation that we're having in healthcare is really mirroring what's going on in society, where there's a consolidation of just about everything, and private equity with leveraged buyouts is behind an awful lot of that. So my hope going forward is that even from the healthcare perspective, we have folks right of center, left of center, who are kind of meeting and at the same conclusion that none of us really like corruption. Unless you're actively sold out to it, you don't really like, unless you are the corrupted neither party really likes corruption or cronyism. So I'm hoping we can have that discussion both in medicine and in the broader discussion of politics in America.
What's the goal of the Take Medicine Back Summit that's coming up at the end of this year? Can you tell us a little bit about that? The goals of the summit, who should attend, who may be interested in attending? Is it hybrid? Are folks going to be able to go attend virtually if things are not safe again at the end of the year? And what time at the end of the year are we talking about the summit, the dates?
Sure. Yeah. Take Medicine Back Summit this year. This will be our second annual summit, although last year focused on emergency medicine almost exclusively. That was the Take EM Back Summit. We had many physicians and emergency physicians who were engaged and wanted to change the system that were involved. We also hosted a day that was made to be public facing the patient advocacy day. And because we need to foster these conversations, and that's a large rationale or reason for hosting this summit, is to foster conversations between groups that normally don't have them. So that includes politicians, it includes the media, it includes nurse advocates, it includes patient advocates and economists and groups that normally just wouldn't talk to each other and have been siloed. So really, this is a pretty broad audience that we're looking at. We expect probably a lot of physicians to be there because this was started by physicians, but we're really trying to increase the transdisciplinary communication. So we have some incredible speakers lined up that I don't want to throw out there until they're confirmed, but people can check back on the takemedicineback.org website as we get more details. It's going to be November 10th through 12th, or excuse me, 10th through 13th. And this is not a traditional setup. The first 2 days are going to be in Charlotte, North Carolina, because that's an easy fly-in and fly-out city. This is also a state that is going through a lot of corporate medicine growing pains and discussions right now. So highlighting that is certainly a part of what we're going to be talking about. And for those who would like to extend the conference, we even expect possibly some mutually exclusive audiences, then they can travel a couple hours west to Asheville, North Carolina, and Western North Carolina, where it's gorgeous and there's great mountains and probably a little bit of foliage left by then. And there we're going to focus a lot on specifically what's going on in Western North Carolina with corporate medicine in terms of HCA and monopolies that are really harming the local population, and they're paying attention. So we want to draw some attention to that and continue the conversation with local politicians and find some solutions.
Can you tell us again the site where folks who want to share their stories, patients who want to share their stories with the different arms that have an interest in taking medicine back, can submit their stories to be discussed during the summit. Can you tell us the site again?
Yeah, I didn't mention this before, so that we have takemedicineback.org. That is our website, all one word. And we also have something called the Phoenix blog. I mentioned earlier that James Keeney wrote the book, The Rape of Emergency Medicine, under a pseudonym. And I think so many people are afraid to speak out. Patients are afraid to speak out. Nurses are, doctors are. And we need a safe way to do that, but still make an impact. Dr. Keeney made a huge impact. And eventually, when he felt like he was in a position to, he revealed who he was. So we want to give some credit to people who are willing to say things, but also give them a little bit of a safer mechanism to do that. So we launched the Phoenix blog in honor of Dr. James Keeney. So people can visit the site, and they are also welcome to email editor@takemedicineback.org, which will go to one of our volunteer editors. Perhaps we can get a story up if they want it to be completely anonymous or to have their name, a pseudonym that resonates with them. We can get something published on that blog, and we have some good relationships with other editors and other publications that we can get those stories out there and keep people safe and anonymous. At the same time, if the patient wants to, or they could potentially be featured, at the conference or even on a larger stage. But we know a lot of people want to stay out of the limelight. So,
and if folks want to subscribe to the Phoenix blog, is there where can we go to say, okay, here's my email, sign me up on the listserv to get the editions of the Phoenix blog?
We are really bootstrapping it, so I don't have a CRM set up. And I'm sure we can talk about that because I've got to work on some of those items. But if you go to the Take Medicine Back website, takemedicineback.org, it will have those emails and we'll probably get a subscription, sign up CRM for that shortly where they can drop an email.
Speaking of writing, and you've got a really busy end of the year coming up, Dr. Lee. I understand you have a book that is coming out at the end of the year with your co-author, Christy Snodgrass, RN of Healthcare Reformed. Can you tell us a little bit about your work with Healthcare Reformed and Christy Snodgrass, RN, and the book? How did you and Christy come together to write How to Hack Your Healthcare?
Sure. So we kind of met through TikTok. She was much more of a little TikTok type celebrity than I was. And interestingly, TikTok has kind of snowballed as a bit of a platform that grew into useful advocacy and discussion as well. So I eventually waded into that and we connected there. I realized that Christy Snodgrass is an RN who had worked in oncology and then worked in case management and sort of saw that angle of corporate exploitation and that really these case managers and nurses who want to help their patients aren't really given the latitude or ability to do that because they're employees of corporations. So we connected on a lot of those issues, but from different angles. She knew the hospital issue and angle more. I knew a lot of the emergency medicine and the direct primary care issue more. And a lot of people reached out to her for, to advertise their services, like, theoretically patient advocacy things. But there's an awful lot to sort through. A lot of resources that some of them are good, some of them are definitely bad, and some of them are in a gray zone. What's the line of trying to help patients, but charging a lot for them, and what's exploitative of vulnerable patients who are now in debt? And that's a tough question to ask, but she and I have spent a lot of time vetting the resources out there and, what are the real, movements in medicine, the real genuine, groups out there that are trying to help people. So we, especially cause I do a lot of this in my practice in direct care, so I can help my patients find the best ways to get the best prices on medication and then labs. We vetted a lot of options together and created more of a guide, almost like a prophylactic guide. If your book is The Crush Medical Debt, it's sort of the emergency care after you suffered a debt disaster. Ours is a little bit more mostly focused on sort of the prophylactic. How do you advocate for you and your family to get the best medical care while being financially prudent and, paying the least, but paying appropriately. So we're not saying everything should be free, but we're saying that you probably shouldn't be price gouged. So how can you get that highest quality healthcare? How can you get the best prices on medications, labs, imaging, even surgeries, and also some resources on what to do in case you do end up with a big bill, whether you had insurance or not. So that's kind of the hope with our guide. And I think it dovetails very much with efforts by you, Marshall Allen, in Never Paid the First Bill. Again, kind of focused on I already have a big bill side of the equation. We rather dovetail with Take Medicine Back and bring the power back to patients and genuine physicians.
How does it go? An ounce of prevention is worth more than a pound of cure, right? So arm yourselves with education so that you don't get into the situation in the first place. You don't, you know what you're looking for. You become medically, financially literate so that you can't be taken advantage of and have your future, your financial future just taken from you. Good stuff. Thank you so much, Dr. Lee. This was really insightful. Really enlightening and much, much appreciated. Thank you so much. You know, there's a lot that you have going on and you're just getting started. So, we're going to have you back after this summit at the end of the year.
I would be happy to. And thank you so much for having me. I'm excited about your book launch as well. It's going to be part of our, it's part of the components, a puzzle piece to this whole solution. So I think we should certainly talk some more and try to help educate patients.
Good stuff. Thank you so much. You take good care.
Thank you. You as well.
Thanks for tuning in to today's show.
We hope we have given you some helpful tips to guide you through your medical journey. Until we talk again, have a beautiful week.